Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to New Heights Show on Education. This is your host, Kathy Woodring. Today's show topic is challenges involved with breaking from British rule, Part 2. First, the life of Thomas Hutchinson will be continued from the last episode. Also, some of the events that led to the American Revolution will be covered. Please remember to click follow us for updates on upcoming shows, or you can visit our website to see host bios and keep track of your favorite host and our shows. New Heights continues to offer its biweekly enrichment day and or co-op classes. Next class will be on April 11th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Classes will be held in Defiance at the Zion Lutheran Church. Tutors and or teachers are needed. We are in need of tutors and or teachers in Defiance and Putnam County. Anyone that would like to volunteer should contact us directly. There are also some paid opportunities. We currently need reading tutors. New Heights is happy to report that we have found a building for our library. We will announce the location once we are settled, which may be in a week or two. We are very thankful to Lynn and Kathy Bergman, Mary Ann Hurst, and Brian Corr for their kindness and generosity. New Heights Educational Group is proud to announce that we now have a new online volunteer. Do you need help in math? Fu Wong, who is currently an international student at Walnut Grove Christian School, Fort Mill, South Carolina. Before arriving in the United States, he lived in Vietnam with his parents and younger sister and did his 10th grade with the highest average grade in his class. At Walnut Grove Christian School, he got an 80-80 in math in this year's PSAT and 800-800 in most of the practical SAT tests. He is now in grade 11 and hoping to get a college scholarship. Fu Wong is a volunteer math tutor with New Heights Educational Group. He loves to help needed students with his best competence. He is looking forward to working as a volunteer math tutor in these areas: geometry, algebra 1 and 2, and pre-calculus. New Heights Educational Group is pleased to have such an educated and industrious person such as Fu Wong participating with New Heights activities. Now to the show topic, challenges involved with breaking from British rule part 2. First, the life of Thomas Hutchinson will be continued from last episode. In London, Benjamin Franklin, acting as the Assembly's agent and eager to have the colony reconcile with England, came to believe that a more conciliatory politician who would not lecture the Assembly on political theory would be able to heal the rift between America and Britain. In order to save the empire, Franklin determined to rid it of Hutchinson. He obtained copies of Hutchinson's private letters of the 1760s and sent them to the Massachusetts Assembly. Samuel Adams had been charging Hutchinson with conspiring to destroy American liberty. The letters, carefully edited and published in the Boston Press, seemed to confirm Adams' charges. Arriving in Massachusetts about the same time as the news that Parliament had passed the Tea Act and that Hutchinson's two sons had been chosen to sell the tea in Boston, the letters destroyed Hutchinson's political credibility. The Assembly demanded his recall. When the tea ships reached Boston in December, Hutchinson's unwillingness to compromise and his adamant belief that the ships could not legally leave port until they had been unloaded provoked the Boston mob, disguised as Indians, to dump the tea into Boston Harbor. Hutchinson asked leave to go to England to propose a solution to the crisis. In his absence, Massachusetts would not get a more conciliatory governor. Instead, General Thomas Gage, the commander-in-chief of the British forces in North America, was named to govern the province. Though Hutchinson urged conciliation, Parliament was now determined to get tough. Hutchinson spent his last years in England hopelessly watching as his native colony became an independent state, and the political connections he had carefully cultivated in England to secure his power in Massachusetts proved only good enough to sustain a meager livelihood in England. Hutchinson died of a stroke on the 3rd of June in 1780. His country home in Milton, Massachusetts, was seized by the state of Massachusetts and sold to revolutionary leader James Warren and his wife, Mercy Otis Warren, sister of Hutchinson's old nemesis. Arthur Lee, American commissioner to France, congratulated the Warrens on that, quote, "It has not always happened that the forfeited seats of the wicked have been filled with men of virtue, but in this corrupt world, it is sufficient that we have some examples of it for our consolation," end quote. The source of this article is Bernard Baylin, B-A-I-L-Y-N, The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchinson, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Belkemp Press of Harvard University Press, 1974. Encyclopedia.com continues with describing Hutchinson's views in history. Thomas Hutchinson believed that the Parliament should be controlling the 13 colonies, but he wasn't a supporter of the Stamp Act. Even though he wasn't a supporter of the Stamp Act, he still enforced the tax. This caused a mob of angry patriots to go to Thomas Hutchinson's house and burn it. His house had the most enriched library ever in the 13 colonies. He was the symbol of loyalty during the pre-revolutionary period, and he was also one of the most hated people in Boston. Hutchinson was born in Boston. He showed remarkable aptitude for business early on, and by the time he was 24, had accumulated considerable property in trading ventures on his own account. He married Margaret Sanford in 1734, who was the granddaughter of Rhode Island Governor Peleg Sanford and a great-grandson of both Rhode Island Governor William Connington and of Anne Hutchinson. As his career advanced, he became involved in the civil leadership of the colony, first as a select man in Boston in 1737. Later in the same year, he was chosen a representative to the Massachusetts General Court, and at once he took a strong stand in opposition to the views of the majority with regard to a proper currency. His unpopular opinions led to his retirement in 1740. In that year, he went to England as a commissioner to represent Massachusetts in a boundary dispute with New Hampshire. In 1742, he was reelected to the General Court and was chosen annually to the General Court until 1749, serving as the Speaker from 1746 to 1749. He continued his advocacy for a sound currency, and when the British Parliament reimbursed Massachusetts in 1749 for the expenses incurred in the Louisbourg expedition, he proposed the abolition of the bills of credit and the utilization of the parliamentary repayment as the basis for a new colonial currency. The proposal was finally adopted by the Assembly, and its good effect on the trade of the colony at once established Hutchinson's reputation as a financier. On leaving the General Court in 1749, he was appointed at once to the Governor's Council. In 1750, he was chairman of a commission to arrange a treaty with the Indians in the District of Maine, which was then part of Massachusetts, and he served on the boundary commissions to settle disputes with Connecticut and Rhode Island. In 1752, he was appointed judge of probate and a justice of the common pleas. In 1754, as a delegate from the Massachusetts to the Albany Convention, he took a leading part in the discussions and favored Benjamin Franklin's plan for colonial union. In 1758, he was appointed Lieutenant Governor, and in 1760, Chief Justice of the Province of Massachusetts. In the following year, by issuing writs of assistance, he brought upon himself a storm of protest and criticism. His distrust of the popular government, as exemplified in the New England town meeting, increased. Although he opposed the principle of the Stamp Act, considered it impolitic, and later advised its repeal, he accepted its legality, and as a result of his stand, his city house was ransacked by a mob in August 1765, and his valuable collection of books was destroyed. For many years, he had been working on a history of the colony, compiling original manuscripts and source materials. After the destruction of his home, he bitterly rescued many of these materials from the muddy road. In 1769, upon the resignation of Governor Francis Bernard, Hutchison became acting governor, serving in that capacity at the time of the Boston Massacre, March 5, 1770, when popular clamor compelled him to order the removal of the troops from the city. In March 1771, he received his commission as governor and was the last civilian governor of the Massachusetts colony. His administration, controlled completely by the British ministry, increased the friction with the patriots. The publication in 1773 of some of the letters on colonial affairs written by Hutchison and obtained by Franklin in England was still further aroused public indignation. In England, while Hutchison was vindicated in discussions of the Privy Council, Franklin was severely criticized and fired as a colonial postmaster general. The resistance of the colonials led the ministry to see the necessity for stronger measures. A temporary suspension of the civil government followed, and General Gage was appointed military governor in April 1774. Driven from the country by threats in the following May and broken in health and spirit, Hutchison spent the rest of his life in exile in England. In England, nominally governor, he was consulted by Lord North in regard to American affairs, but his advice that a moderate policy to be adopted and his opposition to the British Port Bill and the suspension of the Massachusetts Charter were not heeded. While he was still officially the acting governor, he was compelled to refuse a baronetcy because of the severe financial losses when his American estates and other property in Massachusetts were confiscated by the new government without compensation by the crown. Bitter and disillusioned, Hutchison nevertheless continued to work on his history of the colony, which was the fruit of many decades of research. Two volumes were published in his lifetime. His History of Massachusetts Bay, Volume 1 in 1764, Volume 2 in 1767, and Volume 3, 1828. A work of great historical value, calm and judicious in the main, but considered by some to be entirely unphilosophical and lacking in style. His Diary and Letters was published in 1884-86. He died in Brompton, now a part of London, on June 3, 1780, aged 68. Hutchison had built a country estate in Milton, Massachusetts, part of which Governor Hutchison's Field is owned by the trustees of the reservations and is open to the public. He built a ha-ha, or sunken fence, behind the house, which is on the National Register of Historic Places as Governor Thomas Hutchison's ha-ha. These reviews of Thomas Hutchison's life seem to illustrate that Hutchison underestimated the passion for the independence the colonists had. The following article helps to give a more clear picture of the challenges involved with breaking from British rule. Solar Navigator Net covers the American War of Independence and the causes of the war. The first of a series of War of Independence that ended in European control of both North and South America The conflict between Britain and her colonists was triggered by the financial cost of the Anglo-French wars of the previous 30 years, in particular the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63. The principal theater of conflict had been in North America, where it was felt that the colonials had failed to play their part, either financially or in the fighting. In the years immediately after the war, the army in North America consumed 4% of British government spending. This cost, combined with the victories over the French, had increased British interest in their colonies. Ironically, those victories had also removed one element tying the Americans to Britain, fear of French strangulation. In 1756, the French held Canada, the Ohio Valley, and the Mississippi, isolating the British colonies on the eastern seaboard. By 1763, that threat had been removed. At the heart of the division between the colonists and Britain was a fundamentally different concept of the purpose of the colonies. To the British, their American lands were there largely to provide raw materials to Britain and be consumers of British manufactured goods. This feeling expressed itself in an increasing control and restriction of American trade and industry that helped to build up resentment, especially in New England, where manufactured goods for export to the southern colonies was already an important part of the local economy. In contrast, many of the colonists saw themselves as carving a new society from the wilderness, unrestricted by the decisions made 3,000 miles away across the Atlantic. These pressures were tolerable as long as the British regulation of the rules was fairly lax. However, in the decade before the colonies rebelled, there was a new level of interest in exploiting the American colonies. The first move was an attempt to limit further expansion by the colonies. In 1763, it was decided to draw a border behind the existing colonies along the line of the Alleghenies. The land to the west was to be left to the Indians, who were encouraged to become consumers of British goods. New colonists were to be encouraged to go north to Nova Scotia, where they could produce much-needed timber for the Navy, or south to Florida. This limit on their expansion caused much discontent amongst the colonies, costing many, including George Washington, a good deal of money. The next increase in the tension came in 1765 with the Stamp Act and a trade act known as the Sugar Act. It was the Stamp Act that caused the most protest. This was a direct tax levied on the paper required for legal transactions and on newspapers. It had been proposed in 1764, and Americans had been given the year to suggest alternative methods of raising the money needed to administer and defend the colonies. Instead, this year was used to organize opposition to the act. The Stamp Act caused hostility for a variety of reasons. First, the policy of limiting westward expansion that it was intended to help fund was not popular in the colonies. Second, it was the first direct taxation to be imposed on the colonies from London. All previous taxation had been in the form of trade duties. Finally, the Act brought to the fore an issue that was bound to eventually emerge, the status of the legislative assemblies that existed in several of the colonies. In Britain, they were considered to be subordinate to Westminster on all issues. In the colonies, a new theory emerged that the Westminster Parliament had control over imperial issues, but not over colonial taxation. Combined with a boycott of British goods, the riots caused by the Stamp Act caused the fall of the government of Lord Grenville. The new government of Lord Rockingham repealed the Stamp Act in 1766, but at the same time passed a declaratory act confirming parliamentary authority over the colonies. The next government attempt to raise money was the Revenue Act of 1767, put forward by Charles Townshend, then counselor of Echecler. This was a scheme based on indirect taxes on trade, organized across all of the colonies by a board of commissioners. Townsend suggested that the proceeds could fund both the armed forces needed on the borders and a civil list that could free royal governors from any need to rely on colonial assemblies for funding. The government had had reasonable grounds to expect that this new approach would be acceptable. During the controversy over the Stamp Acts, the colonists had accepted the validity of indirect taxation, but instead it was to face protest on both sides of the Atlantic. In Britain, the protest came from those merchants whose exports were being taxed and then boycotted. In America, the Revenue Act arose deep suspicion. The talk of a civil list convinced many that the act was designed to impose absolute authority from Britain. With an expected yield of only 40,000 lira, it was unlikely that any money would be left after the army had been paid for, so these fears were unjustified. But the more radical voices amongst the colonists were able to link the Declaratory Act to the Revenue Act and create a British plot to destroy all colonial liberties. The Revenue Act was commonly held to have overstepped the natural laws that limited the authority of the Parliament. From Massachusetts, Samuel Adams issued a circular letter calling for common action against the Act. At first, this letter appeared to have had little impact, until Lord Hillsborough issued a counter-circular to the colonial governors instructing them to ignore Adams' letter. While the Massachusetts Assembly was suspended, the Massachusetts protest now became a focus of discontent, convincing many, including George Washington, that the British government was intent on gaining total control of the colonies. A campaign of non-importation was launched, although the smuggling of English goods did not stop. Non-importation hit the American ports hard, especially Boston, where lawless conditions eventually forced the British to post troops in the city. Meanwhile, a change of government in Britain brought Lord North to power in 1770. By 1769, the British government had decided to abolish all but the duties on tea, and in 1770, Lord North removed all other duties. Tea was retained in part as a symbol of sovereignty and in part because it raised just over 11,000 lira each year. At the same time, non-importation collapsed in the colonies, as the spread of loneliness convinced colonial opinion that resistance to the Revenue Act was threatening the stability of society. On the 5th of March, 1770, a Boston mob attacked the company of soldiers guarding the customs house. The soldiers stood firm until one was knocked down by the rioters, at which point the soldiers were ordered to fire, killing five of the rioters, called the Boston Massacre. While some radical campaigners saw this as a sign of what they saw as the brutality of British rule, much colonial opinion was repulsed by the actions of the mob. This was especially true in New York, where a radical leader, Alexander McDougall, had used the economic crisis in the port to threaten the authority of the New York Assembly. A conservative reaction set in New York, and at the end of the summer of 1770, New York abandoned non-importation, which soon collapsed across the colonies, leaving only an unwillingness to drink taxed tea. For the next 3 years, it looked as if the danger of a colonial revolt had been averted. Lord North made little or no effort to interfere in the colonies. While in America, intercolony rivalry revived, as typified by the activities of the Green Mountain Boys. However, this image was false. The return to the even grudgingly loyalty only lasted for as long as British didn't act. Expectations and attitudes on the two sides of the Atlantic were too far. Were expectations and attitudes on the two sides of the Atlantic were too far apart for any permanent understanding to be established within the empire. The next episode will continue with the colonial British conflicts, including the Albany Plan of Union. Again, thanks to Lynn and Kathy Bergman, Mary Ann Hurst, and Brian Corr for their kindness and generosity with finding a building for our library. Also, thanks to Fuang for his volunteering as a math tutor in Geometry, Algebra 1 and 2, and Pre-Calculus. The kindness and generosity of people such as these volunteers significantly adds to the success of New Heights Educational Group. We currently have 56 very much appreciated volunteers. Tune in, please tune in next Friday for host Sadia Hijes' show at 6 p.m. Saturdays, you can join host Kaden Behan for her show starting at 6 p.m. Sundays, you can join me, Kathy Woodring, for my show at 11 p.m. Good night and have a great week.